This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and to expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. What if science took into account all the things that can't be measured or quantified? What if hallucinations were real? What if all of the information about you was your own private property to sell? This is Unregistered, and this is my interview with Daniel Coffeen.
So, I'm in my favorite place in San Francisco, the home of Daniel Coffeen.
Yeah,
the great Daniel Coffeen.
Place to be.
Known to Unregistered listeners, known to Renegade University members, as our, what do I call you? Our grand wizard of philosophy?
I'll take that.
And rhetoric?
I'll take that. I'm a sophist, but I'll take that.
Are you?
Yeah.
What's a sophist?
Sophist is, well, I can tell you. You want to know what a sophist is?
You brought it up.
Know what sophist is? I just like sophist because it has, you know, in history of philosophy, it has this, you know, great pejorative connotation, right? Because they're ones who don't believe in truth,
right?
Who just try to teach you to persuade.
I've been called a sophist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I embrace
as an epithet.
Right? Yeah. So I call myself a rhetorician.
Okay.
Right? As opposed to a philosopher, because philosophers seek to build a system in which to derive absolutes, which to derive truths, right? Well, rhetoric is never concerned with such things. Begin
right.
from a different perspective, right? And ask, what does this do? What are the effects of this? How does this, what does this inaugurate? What, ask different kinds of questions.
Mm-hmm.
And so a sophist is a practicing rhetorician.
Interested in language, not at getting at the truth.
No,
not at fixing problems. Interested
no,
in
no,
the
no,
play
no,
of
no,
words.
No. Oh my God, no, not at all.
Oh my God.
No, my God. So you conflated all of a sudden getting at the truth and fixing problems. Those are, may or may not be inclusive or exclusive of each other,
okay.
Right? Now the sophist will always, it depends on the problem. If the problem is you're trying to derive truth, that's fine.
Okay.
But rhetoric always comes to the situation assuming that there are all kinds of things to ask of any situation. And that you can't separate the mechanics and the expression from the expressed.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that they're all intertwined,
mm-hmm.
and that language is always already social, right?
Yep.
It's always already part of, when I taught rhetoric at Cal, I taught the introduction to the lecture, and it was supposed to be the introduction to the major.
Yep.
And it was supposed to be all about syllogisms and all that crap, and it's so uninteresting to me. So the title of my class was The Art and Practice of Circumstantial Propriety.
What does that mean?
Meaning, I love this idea of a protean standard, right? So philosophy is always after absolutes,
mm-hmm.
right? What is, you know, the Kantian moral imperative,
yeah.
right? Some rule that can apply across all circumstances.
Everywhere and at all times.
Exactly, no matter what. The Ten Commandments are a great example, right?
Mm-hmm.
You shouldn't want to fuck thy neighbor's wife, no matter what. Even if you guys are madly in love and her husband
no matter when,
her,
no matter yeah. where,
no matter,
right.
just don't,
no matter
stup,
who,
don't
right.
even think about her, don't even covet her. So really?
Thou shalt not yeah. stoop. Yeah.
But there are all kinds of circumstances in which coveting one's neighbor's wife might be a good, healthy, vital thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it doesn't mean, one of the great sort of fallacies of philosophy is that if you get rid of standards, you inaugurate chaos.
That's it.
But rhetoric, and in fact, a lot of postmodern philosophy, Deleuze, Foucault, they come in from the other side and say, no, 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 you don't eliminate them. You actually proliferate them.
Mm.
So rhetoric, there are rules all the time. You're always mm-hmm. feeling them out every single moment,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's, how do you know when to reach for your drink? How do you know when to reach in for the kiss? How do you know when to say something? How do you know when to leave the room? you're constantly feeling for the right thing. It's collaborative, it's emergent. Mm. It's not dictated by any one party, it's fundamentally ecological. Mm-hmm. But there still is a time. You know that. The one I always think about, I don't know why I always think about this particular example, but sitting in like a sauna, you know, there's a great thing. You're sitting in a sauna and you're waiting for that moment. You're not quite comfortable yet. And then there's an inflection point in which you're pervaded, right? The heat has changed you fundamentally. And then shit starts to get a little weird, mm-hmm. right? Because there's a point at which if you stay there too long, things are going to get ugly.
You get scared too.
Yes.
I do.
Yeah, absolutely.
At a certain point, right?
There's going to be this another inflection point. Mm-hmm. How do you know when to get up and go?
Right.
Right? And then there's, of course, social politics. Maybe you're wedged in. I go to the Kabuki Hot Springs here in San Francisco. There's all these naked men lying around and you're way up in the corner and all of a sudden you're a little woozy and you might fall. You don't know what you're going to hit. And you're. Yeah. How do you know that right moment? It's this weird combination of the social, my body, time. And just because I've done it before, 25 minutes is always the time to leave, doesn't mean this time it's not 18 minutes
okay.
or 17.5. Meaning, even for myself, there's no absolute continuous rule. I'm in flux. The social's in flux. Every event, every encounter is an emergent collaboration, right? That's inflected by history. I've been in a sauna before. I've been in the situation before. So I know at some point if I stay here, it's going to get ugly. I'm going to get dehydrated. I'm going to pass out. I may die. I may vomit. All kinds of things might happen. I know if I leave too early, I won't feel quite saturated. I still have a kind of mm-hmm. itch. So I'm looking for what in rhetoric is called kairos, the propitious moment. Mm. And in classical rhetoric, kairos was this goddess.
Oh, we talked about this with Venkatesh Rao in an episode just a few weeks ago. Okay, right. Kairos was the god of a different kind of time, as opposed to Kronos.
Yes, exactly.
Kairos, will you tell me how you interpret Kairos?
So Kairos in rhetoric was always this propitious moment, right?
Mm-hmm. And right. A moment of opportunity.
Moment of opportunity.
Okay.
The moment where something comes. And it's a couple, the two examples I always give to think about Kairos. One is the gunfight scenes. Think about the good, the bad, and the ugly. It keeps flashing between these guys' eyes, right? Mm. What's the moment you draw your gun? How do you know when to draw? What's that opportunity? You're looking for that moment where you get to step. And it's imperceptible except to the gunslinger.
And it's contingent on the social.
And everything that's happening right then and there.
Is that right?
Circumstantial.
The other gunfighters, yes. The other people involved in the scene.
Exactly.
Okay. Oh,
and it's
okay.
Circumstantial.
And therefore unpredictable also.
Yes, unpredictable. You don't know beforehand, right?
Right. Yeah.
A great example, of course, is in the dating world. And one of the beauties, of course, of dating, of romance, is when do you make that move? When do you bust a move?
Yeah.
You're looking for that opportunity.
Yeah.
And one of the things that disappoints me about a lot of what's happening in campuses with consent is, this is going to get me all kinds of trouble, but of course, takes away Kairos, right? You're no longer considered liable for assessing the emergent logics. Mm. You have to stop and refract it through some sort of abstract logic, right?
The logic, first of all, there's a logic imposed
yes.
before the encounter right. by the institution
right.
or by some moral code, right?
Right?
You are supposed to ask or make a move at this point and not anytime else,
yeah.
right? Right, that's Kronos, I suppose.
Exactly.
That's living according to
yes.
Kronos, right?
Yes.
Kairos is, as you're saying, a sort of contingent, social, always changing, emergent. Time, I suppose, or way of telling time, or way of
yeah,
thinking
but except
about
it's,
time.
Yeah, it's a way of thinking about time, but Kairos is not just time itself, it's a moment.
In time.
That's, you know, and so for the classical rhetoricians, Kairos was usually, would come very rarely, and it was always this big thing. Like, now's your time to strike and kill Caesar. In modern rhetoric, which is what I am, Kairos is every moment. Mm-hmm. When do I shut up and defer to you? When do I reach for my drink? When we're making these things are always sort of emerging according to sort of almost like chaos theory. There's an order there, but it's only visible or can be known after the fact, and yet we're always acting.
So Nietzsche, you teach about Nietzsche for us, and you've done a lot of work on Nietzsche. Like, he talks about the big moments, seizing the moments, opportunities. He talks about Kairos in these ways, maybe not exactly this way, but...
Well, he was a rhetorician.
Yeah, I know. And so, but is this how you read Nietzsche, too? Or
Yeah,
I mean, well, no, sorry. Yeah. Do you read him as the modern version? Do you read him as there always being these emergent moments of opportunity?
Nietzsche was...
I'm not so sure, actually.
Yeah, I'm not so sure because he was so disdainful of me sitting in the hot tub or the sauna deciding when I'm going to get the fuck up to leave, right?
He would say what?
He still has a grandiose... He just wouldn't care. Mm. Where I kind of care. I love these little moments. Mm. I love that moment. I love... it. To me, it's... far and away the most interesting thing about dating is when is that moment? What reading it, right? I mean, that's the only thing really that almost salvages the horror of having to deal with other human beings is negotiating these sort of propitious moments. The example I used to always give was in classical rhetoric, you had Fred Astaire, right? Everyone's on stage, or he's on stage and everyone's looking at him, mm-hmm. right? And he dances in a set environment that's special. It's momentous, right? The modern rhetorician is Gene Kelly. He dances alone out in the rain, on the street, in a tenement. He dances any moment whatsoever, anywhere whatsoever.
Spontaneously.
Yeah, and it emerges. So he's walking down the city street, and he'll dance anywhere and anywhere.
That's right. And he's creating, he's choreographing as he moves.
Exactly.
And he choreographs as he encounters new space,
yeah,
new objects,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, I mean, one of my I don't even remember what film it's from. Where I've maybe only seen the clip of it. Where he's in like a burnout apartment, some tenement, and he does an entire dance with a old newspaper. Mm. He's like kicking up pieces of it, uh-huh. right? Anything can be your partner, yep. any moment whatsoever.
Yep.
Think about Gene Kelly versus Fred Astaire.
Yeah,
the special moment versus every moment. It's not that it's special, but that is a moment of reckoning.
Uh-huh.
Right, the sort of micro reckonings.
Uh-huh.
And that once you begin thinking in terms of kairos and thinking in terms of emergent propriety, it's not the absence of propriety, it's that it's emergent.
Right.
So it is there, but it's always multiple and it's always perspectival. Right. So rather, Deleuze will talk about this in Spinoza, the difference between morality and ethics. Right, so, and Foucault does this in his History of Sexuality, Volume 2, is he looks for that moment at which Greco-Roman senses of propriety become Christian, right? So for the Greco-Romans, it was never, you know, don't fuck boys. It was fuck the right boy at the right time. Mm-hmm. So there was something you could do wrong, but I can't tell you beforehand what that is.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
It's no, you know, always be prudent when you're eating. But it depends what prudence means. It's a protean standard.
And
it's not that a standard.
And it's contingent. Is that the right word too?
Yeah, it's okay. Contingent. Yeah, yeah. It's ecological.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's still a standard. So the idea of a protean standard, mm-hmm. which is a phrase I steal from my friend, the poet Lauren Green, in his great book, Poetical Dictionary, where he wrote a dictionary according to a protean standard. If you look at a classical dictionary, each word is defined according to the same tone. Right? So butterfly, euphony, fascism, gnat, concrete, the definition is all written in the same voice. Mm. It's all this sort of monotone that tries to evacuate any perspective.
Now we're getting
neutral.
Now we're getting into caffeine territory here.
And so at Lauren Green's book, he wrote a dictionary in which it's a true dictionary. It only has about 40 words in it because each one is complicated, and it's a true definition and pronunciation. But each word is defined according to its sense. So his definition of glee, it's gleeful, right? Acrobat, if you read it and read it out loud, it plants its landing. Purple, it's purple. Bleak, bleak is bleak, right? Okay. So the whole definition is contingent on the sense of this word.
Sense.
There's no neutral voice outside of it. And so sense is inclusive of both meaning and this other thing, this sort of mood or affect.
Affect. Okay.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Now you're okay. Now you're Daniel Coffin again. Okay. Now it's all coming together here.
Okay.
Now, how are you a sophist?
So the sophist is the one who operates in a world of emergent circumstantial propriety, as opposed to one who operates ever seeking. So when I read something or engage with something, I don't want the fucking right answer. I'm not looking for that. I don't want to know what's true or right. I want to know, what do I do now? What happens here? What action will I take? How will this serve my vitality? How will this please me? How will this mm-hmm. make me healthier? How will this, what will it do?
It's all about you, huh?
Is it true?
It's all about you. No, it's self-interested.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
It's individualistic.
It's individualistic, sure. Yeah. Because it's perspectival.
I'm liking it. I'm just saying.
Absolutely.
You would be criticized by many people.
Well, because it's perspectival.
Especially in this town for saying such a thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a very conservative town.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
I never did
San Francisco is a conservative town.
Most conservative town I've ever been in.
Wow. What do you mean by that?
It's a town of bigots. Are you kidding? Just try to say anything.
Keep going.
Try to say, I don't believe, here's one that happens to me all the time. I don't like traveling. Nothing liberals love fucking more than traveling.
And especially apparently women on dating apps. Have you noticed? They've all been to every country.
And they're very proud of it.
Oh yeah.
I
will not date a woman who puts anything about traveling on their app, on their profile. It's
Got my passport at the ready.
I don't care what they look like. They could be the most amazing woman in the world. If they talk about traveling, sorry, honey.
So I had to tell you a story. When I was on this date with this woman, and it's the first date, and travel comes up, and I know at this point, based on circumstantial propriety, that this ain't going anywhere. So I got nothing to lose, nothing to win. It's just okay. I'm kind of bored. She's not very interesting. And she starts talking about travel, and I knew it was going to be provocative. I knew it, but I still couldn't resist. I was like, yeah, why do you like to travel? And the look of horror on her face, like, what kind of animal was I? And she said, well, traveling expands my worldview.
Right.
And I couldn't help it.
What'd you say?
I said, well, clearly not enough to understand people who don't like to travel. I guess your worldview wasn't that inclusive, right? You'd get that expansive.
Oh, God.
Yeah, she left before I paid the bill, before the bill came. She
really?
Out the door, yeah.
Oh, dude.
I don't even know why I had to pay. She should have had to pay that disaster. But yeah, so I mean, there's a certain...
Okay, so sophists are playing. This would be both... I mean, some people would see that as a criticism. I see it as a great thing.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by play?
You're not like... You said you don't give a fuck about, like, the outcome, finding truth.
Well, those are, again, two different things. I do care about the outcome. The truth and the outcome might not be related. And, in fact, that's what Nietzsche keeps coming back to. It's like if people who like truth were actually interested in truth, they'd be confronted with this merciless, devastating, sublime horror.
Mm-hmm. You don't have an overarching objective.
Right, exactly. Not predetermined.
That's it.
I don't have a plan.
The modernist, yes. Right, wants to build the Hoover Dam, you know, wants to, you know, go to war in a foreign land to conquer it,
right.
Wants to solve some mathematical question that's been here for ages, right? Wants to, you know, discover a new species.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
That's not what you're about. I mean, you're not opposed to that stuff.
Yeah, and there are rhetorical approaches to all those things,
okay.
But it's not... It's, again, whenever there's any kind of standard of behavior or standard of knowledge or, again, reading a film or reading a book or it's not, you know, one of the, I can't remember who makes this distinction between teleological and teleonomical.
Teleology is what we're getting at here, right?
So teleology is moving towards a telos, a purpose, an endpoint. Teleonomy would be what I'm talking about, which is you're always going... And you're always going the direction you're going, but it's not predetermined. You're neither lost nor found. It's why a figure I come back to a lot is the middle voice, right? And we don't have a lot of vocabulary in English to talk about this middle position.
Okay.
The Buddhists talk more about it.
I was going to say, this is reminding me of wise mind in mindfulness.
Yeah. Okay. Exactly, yep. And so that sort of middle position where you're neither active nor passive, right? It's the do-nothing, it's the wu-wai, right?
Right.
For the sophist, or at least my... caffeine sophistry, we're always already positioned in this middle voice. And one way I think about that is, think about perception, let's say vision. I used to use this example for my students all the time. When I'm looking at the glass, am I looking at it or is it coming to me? Right? From a certain perspective, vision is totally passive. Mm-hmm. I'm just getting inundated. The whole fucking world is filling me up. You can't help it. And if you start thinking about it, it will freak you the fuck out, right? Like, stop coming in my head. Stop coming at me, right? The other side is, no, I look. I'm the object, right? And I can see something. I'm the subject and it's the object.
Yeah.
I will own that thing in looking at it.
And you determine it.
But then you get Merleau-Ponty, the great French phenomenologist, who says, no, it's a chiasm. It's intertwining. That which sees is that which can be seen. I can only see the glass because I am the same stuff as the glass. And to see is a kind of palpation. Mm. And if you think about sight as touch, it seems touch more explicitly breaks down the boundaries between subject and object, right? Because mm-hmm. I'm touching you, you're touching me, necessarily. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean it's parallel. Doesn't mean they're equal, right? Clearly, you grab somebody, it's different than two people holding hands. Mm-hmm. And yet, if I grab someone, they're still touching me, right? But that's the same of vision, same of all senses, right? The whole perceptive event is always situated in this middle position, in this middle voice.
Okay, so you have a choice you're facing right now. Do you want to talk about sex or drugs?
Oh, I really have to choose.
Yeah, your two favorite things. You describe yourself as a drug-addled pervert. So I figured that would be...
Sex, I'll be honest.
We'll talk about both, so don't worry.
All right, let's talk about drugs. Drugs seem safer.
Let's do drugs, yeah, okay.
Sex is only going to get me in trouble.
Right, okay. So we're going to talk about sex, too. Yeah. So you have written on your blog, an emphatic oomph, the great blog, my favorite blog.
Although it's a title you don't like.
You have to change the title
right, you come
of
up
the overall blog. Yeah,
that's You're very true. Kind.
You do, yeah. But the blog I love. So you wrote a piece... a blog post just a couple of weeks ago, right?
Yeah.
On hallucinogenics.
Yes.
Psychedelics.
Yes.
And you have extensive experience with these drugs.
Yeah.
Enough.
Yeah, but I have enough. I don't know if extensive is the right word, but yeah.
Yeah, you're drug addled.
It's all relative, yeah.
Well, let's talk about like how long you've been doing drugs, what kinds, and your general experience.
Yeah. And in fact, I wrote that because...
Your drug biography. What is
that? Yeah, I mean, I started smoking pot in, I don't know, eighth grade, I don't know, mm-hmm. 12, 13 years old. Mm-hmm. I just took to it, right? I mean, it was good. But I also knew how to use it. I've always been a good drug taker like that. Like, I was never the sloth sitting there ripping and bong hits in the morning. I mean, I've done all that, but that wasn't my thing. Mm-hmm. And I always found pot, so I still think pot is in a way the prince of drugs.
Really?
The prince of psychedelics,
I thought you were a little bit down on pot.
No, I love pot. It's just a challenge. And this is what I love about it.
Okay, okay.
You know? Right, and pot is just great at revealing, I think, a lot of the micromechanics of the social. I can see how I'm acting in a relationship. I can see relationships over time.
For me, that came off. At first, it was paranoia and hyper self-consciousness, which I hated.
Yes.
That's why I stopped smoking it for 30 years. And then I got back into it just a couple of years ago. And now I see what you're saying, right? It's now that I think, unfortunately, because it's been destigmatized, because it's now legalized, I'm sorry to say the state got into my head.
Yeah.
But I do think that's why I no longer get that paranoid when I get high.
That's interesting.
I know. It's fucking the state, man.
That's funny, because that actually kind of bummed me out. You know, I did not vote for...
You voted, you bastard.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Okay, we'll get to
that. I did vote for the first time. But I would not have voted for the legalization. I knew the state getting in. Well, my pot was a problem because it was de facto legal. I've never tried to get pot.
Prop 17 in this state.
Yes.
I voted against it too because I could read it and it said we will give the industry to the corporations we select and no one else will be allowed in. It almost says that explicitly.
Yeah,
it's like a two paragraph resolution. I was like, you're kidding me. It's so plain. So I voted against it.
Yeah, it seemed
all right. So we.
So, but then I discovered I did LSD my junior year in high school and fuck, it was something, man. It was fucking something. You know, and then I get to college and, you know, I had a pretty steady diet of LSD and mushrooms. You know, and then there were some other drugs that were not that interesting, like crack cocaine, which was big in the 80s in Philadelphia. It was very easy to get, but it was so uninteresting. It was fun, but it wasn't interesting. And then I got to a point with psychedelics that was like, I felt like I was done. Mm-hmm. Right? I remember my second to last trip, I was at a Dead show in Philadelphia. It was summer, I'm hot, I'm outside. And I'm like, I'm on the floor, which I never went. I'm agoraphobic and misanthropic. I'm never down the ground. It's a big outside stadium, down on the floor. And I'm like, this is so delicious and so grotesque and boring.
Wait, you hate the outdoors and people.
Yeah, yeah. So there I am, like on the floor at the show in Philly. And I just remember just shooting up through the sky and being like, I am done. I know things. I don't need the drug. And then I had one more trip after that, at that period, that was just epic on the ocean. And I felt like I'd reached a point where I understood what I needed to understand, which was a certain flow. I mean, what I see now is what psychedelics, unlike pot, I think with weed, people really the parody is people think about big issues on weed. But that's not what weed is good at. Weed is really, hence the paranoia, it's really local. It's horizon
about,
point.
Yeah. It's about, it's for not me, it's that, about myself.
Yeah, it's yeah, not
I,
that
I,
far
I become out. Inward looking. Okay.
Cool. But the horizon does not go, you know, again, the stoner is supposed to be sitting there wondering about the cosmos. But that, to me, that's not really what happens. I can read the TV show really well. I can see all the mechanics yeah. of how the movie was put together. The psychedelics I've been interested in, so LSD, mushrooms, and I'm going to say MDA, MDMA. I know people don't consider that a psychedelic, but I do. And they all, in different ways, do different things. I don't think psychedelics are about different paths to the same place.
Okay.
I think they all are a different thing.
And
different
DMT, education. You've done DMT too.
And then DMT, which yeah. is sort of a different beast. Yeah. But I'll include DMT in there and say what they do is they just shift your horizon point, right? So that, and this is something I've been sort of obsessed with over the years, is just depending on what your focal point is, what your horizon point is, your whole sense of propriety, your whole sense of life changes, right? So if you're looking out and you see this buildings and you see men and women and you're like, I want a job and I need a date. That, and that's your horizon point. And we all know people like that. That's where the horizon begins and ends. Mm-hmm. Right? Or that's at least a parody. I don't know people like that, but I assume there are people like that who really care about their job and care about their dating.
They're out there, I promise you.
Yeah. And so the horizon is just a super limited point. I get it.
Right.
That's what they think their world is.
Right.
And so, of course. But then you can shift up to the sky and you can shift. You can keep going, right? To the solar system, to the cosmos, to all time, always, and all time and space. And what I've found those drugs to do is shift it. They dramatically shift my horizon point. So I don't do self-examination because self-examination is absurd. It becomes this egotistical thing, right? It kind of unplugs me from my self-examination and just says, shh, none of that matters. You don't have to think about all that. Whether she likes me, doesn't like me, or I don't have enough money to make my rent. Shh.
Really?
It's okay. There's the ocean. There's a cosmic becoming that you're just flowing through. You are matter, continuous with great cosmic becoming. I am, you know, what's the great Joni Mitchell song? You know, we are gold dust.
Uh-huh.
We are 3 million year old carbon. And that's, to me, what, at the most sort of general level, the psychedelic experience has done for me is just displacing ego as a central point.
Ego. Is the issue here?
Yeah,
is the problem?
It's not a problem, but yeah, I think ego gets leads to anxiety, and
psychedelics is the solution or a
I
solution.
Think so, yes,
no shit.
I think so.
I mean, because ego, the way you describe it here, has been identified by many other kinds of people as a problem, right?
Yeah.
Blocking us from doing various things,
yes.
Right? But psychedelic drugs not often prescribed as the solution.
I think they rupture and they just shift your point of resonance. To me, it's almost. It doesn't need to be some big mystical thing. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was writing about in that blog post, is that psychedelics for me are not, you could couch it in mystical language, but to me it's a kind of radical empiricism. You're participating in, or can literally see and participate in things that are happening right around you that are generally just not considered.
I mean, you're making an epistemological claim too in that piece, right?
Completely.
Which is really, I think, the main argument in there, isn't it? And that's the most radical part, which is the hallucinations are not just hallucinations. They're not just made up. They are really happening.
Yes. Yeah, there's something so interesting to me. I mean, just completely nonsensical about a hallucination is seeing what's not there.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you even parse that sentence? It doesn't make any sense.
Because you are seeing it.
It's there in some, it might not be there materially. It might not be there quantifiably. But it's their quality.
But neither is an idea.
Exactly.
Right? Have ideas changed the world? Of course.
Exactly. And so you're seeing things that are there that you just don't. Secretly, that piece was a rant, which has been an ongoing rant of mine against science, which are scientific methods.
So you want to classify it as a phenomenon?
Yes.
What you see in a hallucination?
Exactly.
You want to classify it? I said.
Exactly.
So within phenomenology, it would be something that could be studied.
Exactly.
It should be studied.
It should be studied and part of knowledge. And what's so interesting to me is the way science and religion somehow duped us into thinking they're opposed.
Boom.
Where they're 100% going after the same thing. They all have a disdain for the body. They all go for an abstract truth. They all ignore the unbelievable wealth and breadth of data and information that's around us all the time that is fundamentally ecological, mm-hmm. qualitative.
Affective,
right? That can't be, we always assume
social.
That affect is subjective, mm-hmm. but it's not, it's perspectival, but it's not subjective.
To take Daniel's course on Nietzsche, or to talk to him one-on-one via what we call office hours, go to renegadeuniversity.com. To attend the Renegade University weekend in Oakland and San Francisco with Daniel and me, which is April 24th, 25th, and 26th, go to renegadeuniversity.com/live.
So I'm reminded when you talk about this of Foucault's whole argument about how discourse never takes away, it never subtracts. Yeah. Repression doesn't really happen. There is no such thing as a repression that takes things out of the world, right? The attempt to repress sexuality just creates new language about sexuality, which we then glom onto, and then creates its own discourse and its own reality and its own meaning. Like the classic example is homosexuality was not a concept until the late 19th century. Then they invented it, and then people were like, oh yeah, that's me, I'm homosexual, and this is who I am, and then it went on from there. And so I think it sounds similar here that with psychedelic drugs, that you are, these things that you're seeing that are not tangible, not manifest in the physical world, can't measure them, a real new form of discourse.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yes. New, yeah. And you said it's a new horizon, a new way of thinking and about yourself, about the world, but it's a new words, new concepts, new languages.
Well, there's the experience, and then there's how it's accounted for culturally or discursively.
Right. But the hallucination itself is a form of discourse, no?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying.
Maybe, except discourse I always see as an emergent social thing, right? It's between amongst people, right? It's the definitions of what the limits of what can be said and not said. It's the constitution of what counts as the true, what constitutes.
Wait, I want to dig into this. Why isn't a hallucination a new form of discourse in Foucauldian terms?
It seems as such an emergent idiosyncratic figure, right? That becomes almost purely phenomenological, right? That it's just you're confronted with this thing, but it doesn't mean the terms of how it's
because it's not deliberate. That's why you want to say it's not discourse.
It's not talked about. I mean, discourse is that which is talked about.
I mean, okay. So, discourse. I mean, normally the way we think about this is, you know, points of light. Sounds come into our heads,
right.
We perceive the senses, then we make sense of it.
Okay.
We fashion it into language or concepts or feelings, and that is what we call discourse in our world.
I think we're using the word differently, which is just
sort of the mind's mediation of the outside world, right? But so with hallucinations, there's nothing coming in from outside necessarily, it's all coming from inside, but the mind is creating something. The mind is creating something new. Something brand new in the world, no?
There's a lot of things there. So one is, I'm not sure that hallucination is seeing is coming up. It's coming out of me.
Yeah.
It's coming out of an encounter with me with something.
So it's not social.
It might or might not be social, but it's not that it's just, I might see demons from my childhood or something like that, which is what I might call a subjective, right? Mm-hmm. But the perspectival is a perspective on my localized perspective on some kind of phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
Discourse I always see as the sort of social laws dictating the flow of how something can or cannot be sort of figured semantically.
Yes.
In terms of any sort of value, social value, semantic value, significance, right? So what I think what's beautiful in a way about often for people in the psychedelic experience is that it ruptures so much of discourse. And so they don't know how to situate it. Right, it becomes, you know, Foucault's world or words, it becomes sort of monstrous, right? It doesn't fit anywhere. It becomes madness. It becomes a thing that doesn't fit. As opposed to beginning, what I'm hoping to do is begin to create a discourse of these kinds of data points.
Okay.
These kinds of experiences, affect is constitutive of discourse. I want to infuse discourse with the things that it normally excludes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, you're targeting, a particular kind of discourse. I don't think Foucault differentiated between scientific, rationalistic discourse and affective discourse. I mean, you think for him,
but
it's all...
But for this, for me, Foucault was always talking about discourse. Are the terms of the rules in which anything can circulate, the value it has in its circulation, its social circulation,
okay,
in which you are figured as a subject, mm-hmm, but that I think the beauty of Foucault is always his experience outside, right, which he loved, right, which is why he likes going down to the Eagle and getting ass fucked.
The bathhouse, fucking bandana,
you know, yes, you know, like that was his joy because
to put it gently, yes.
Yes. you know, he taught in my department long before I was there. You know, he taught in the rhetoric department.
Oh, for like a year, right?
He really always wore white leather pants. I don't know, it was before my time.
That's right, of course.
I don't know why I love that.
That's right.
But discourse to me is not the limit term of that which can be said and thought. It's the constraints upon which things that are said and thought are figured and situated.
Okay. So the hallucination resides entirely in your mind until you...
It's not entirely in your mind.
I'm agreeing with you, I thought.
I know, but it's outside the discourse, but it doesn't mean it's outside...
But once
only
you...
Only contained to my mind.
But I'm saying, then once you... If you articulate it then to others... Yeah. Socially, then it becomes part of discourse, does it?
Yeah, or even my. Even,
okay.
Yeah, or even I think what makes people troubled is you're having an experience. Mm-hmm. You're like, I don't know how to situate this, right? It doesn't have a place, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and I think it's why people like me start reading Terence McKenna or Deleuze and Guattari. It began to have a discursive home, a place where this kind of experience could be figured and had value, as opposed to just being monstrous, scary, outside, disruptive.
Yeah.
At a positive value.
Yeah. Don't you describe it as a process of discovery? Hallucinating?
Sure, I think so.
I think that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
You're finding new things rather than just hallucinating about stuff that doesn't exist.
Oh, right, yes, absolutely. It's always there. There's no such thing that doesn't exist.
There's something
you can't hallucinate something that doesn't exist. Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, now is it a discovery or a creation? Again, this is another argument postmodernists have, right?
Yeah.
For me, everything's a creation. And that's how I read Foucault and Derrida. Like, everything for them is a creation. If you're discovering it, that's presupposing that something exists outside of consciousness.
I think there are. I think it depends. I don't think it has to be one or the other. I think it depends on your posture towards the thing. So I'm sitting on this rug. You see this red rug down here. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting with my friend, and it's pitch black in the room, and we're smoking a DMT vape pen.
You're talking about an actual experience you just had?
Yes.
Which you just wrote about
in
your blog, too.
It wasn't even a vape pen. We were smoking changa, right? Which was a bunch of herbs mixed with DMT.
With DMT. You were smoking DMT.
Smoking DMT, but not just straight DMT. So you're not just blasting off.
Yeah, no, thank you.
So it's more of a...
And you wrote about this, by the way, in your blog.
Yes.
I read it, yes. Okay.
And it's pitch black, yet somehow we can see, and partially that's ambient light, and partially your pupils are dilated, and partially you can just see things at a different wavelength, which is what I'm beginning to poke at the notion of discovery.
Okay.
So I notice these strands floating through the air, and I'm like, huh. You know, because, you know, I'm old, I see shit, I don't know. But I'm like, huh, look, I could hold them. And then I'm sitting with my friend, and I was like, hey, and he could see them too. There was no issue. It wasn't like, oh, that's weird. It just took them, and we could pull these little strands of light, or I don't know what they were.
You had the same hallucination.
But it wasn't hallucination, is what I'm saying, right? So it was that's just what I would say was discovery. There was something there that we don't normally see.
That you wouldn't have seen if you weren't tripping.
Right.
Really?
And this is yes. This is where I was headed.
Now you're like in UFO territory.
This is where I'm headed. Yeah, 100%.
Oh, you really? Wow. So you really think so it is discovery. This is like...
Yes.
Oh.
So this is what I'm saying.
So this should be like in the science building.
This is what I'm saying. Yes, it's scientific.
I don't know if I like this anymore.
So what I'm saying is that between... We see ourselves as objects or subjects in the room situated with these sort of positions. And that between us... What right now? Between us? What's between us right now? Uh-huh. What is this?
Occasionally little flecks of spittle.
I'm a spitter. I'm a spitter, yeah, absolutely.
Just occasionally.
Yeah, what else?
None of them have hit me, by the way.
What else?
I mean, air. I can smell the beer and tequila you're drinking down here.
Yeah.
Lots of feelings.
Lots of feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So Merleau-Ponty says that it's infinitely dense. It was Leibniz. Actually, it goes back to Leibniz, right?
Yeah.
The sort of inventor of the Baroque, right? Of the world that's of the plenum. The plenum.
Yeah.
One of my favorite fucking concepts. And that once I figured the plenum, everything changed
for me. What's the plenum? Define it.
Plenum says If we say the earth, the world, the cosmos, the universe is a plenum, it is full. It means there is no such thing as nothing. It is full. It doesn't mean it can't keep going. You add more, it just keeps, it is always at its limit, but its limit is always changing. Mm-hmm. But there is no empty space. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I guess there's a famous book, I don't know, about this debate between Hobbes and Boyle, about, I guess, 17th century, about the possibility of a vacuum.
Right.
And I'm just, again, I might be making this up. This is my memory from grad school. But that, you know, Hobbes was a plenist, who argued that there's no such thing as a vacuum. Right? The, between me and you, there's infinite, this is infinitely rich. Right. There's as much stuff between me and you as there is in you or in me. Mm-hmm. And Boyle's like, no, he happened to, I think, invent something that could create a vacuum. So, you know, following Trotsky or Adorno, right? You follow yep. ideas that come back to profit motive.
Yes.
He wants to sell his vacuum machines. And so we began to create a scientific method premised on establishing knowledge in a no place.
There it is.
And knowledge in a no place, nice. To me, might have some effective value, but it seems to me fundamentally nihilistic. Mm-hmm. Knowledge based on something that can't possibly exist and saying that which is true is that which I can establish in a place that can't possibly exist and in which human life is annihilated.
What's the place that can't That's possibly exist? Which is the place of logos, right? And rationality?
Oh.
Is that what you mean?
Well, no, I mean that think about the lab, scientific lab.
Yes.
Tries to create these sort of these conditions in which the subjective or which,
yeah.
I mean, they make everything white.
Yeah, I'm right.
Somehow white.
Science takes, yes. creates a place, the scientific which, method right. creates a place where nothing, where humanity, human beings can't exist.
And quite literally create a vacuum. And they say if you right. drop if oh, you drop right. a cannonball and a feather.
Right, it's sterilized. It's
right. And they fall the same pace.
The external right. world is forced out.
Exactly.
That's right. The world is forced out.
And think about that's the right. will for that. The will that says, I'm going to know the truth
Ooh.
By getting rid of the world.
Ooh.
Well, that's nihilism, what? Right? Who are you? What kind of will is that?
That is that's a devastating critique of science.
Yeah.
Jesus, Daniel.
That's Nietzsche.
I know. Well, but he didn't say
it's
it like
me
that.
Me extenuating, pushing.
Yeah, where does Nietzsche say that?
He talks about truth and religion are the same thing because they both seek the truth.
Yeah.
He doesn't talk about the vacuum.
He doesn't do that part.
But he implies that there's a nihilism to
Damn,
science.
Damn, I was feeling pretty good about science recently because, you know, I was interviewed Donald Hoffman at UC Irvine just a few weeks ago, and he's a neurocognitive scientist. Mm-hmm. He's a scientist in the yeah. science buildings yeah. at UC Irvine, right? Yeah. And he was saying, physicists now are sure that time and space are going to be anachronistic, that there is something outside of time and space, that we're going to be thinking completely differently about everything.
I like that.
And they're into this. And yeah. I'm like, oh my God, this is incredible. A scientist is admitting this.
Yeah.
He also said to me, a scientist, yeah. that no scientific theory has ever been proven. Not one.
I love that.
So yeah, I was feeling all good about science, yeah. but now you're...
My problem with science is that it's not empirical. That if you begin actually being empirical, you start taking into consideration things that can't be measured.
Okay, so right. So this is the Daniel Coffeen 101. This is pretty much the subject of your book, right? And let's be clear about this. And this is what you're going to be talking about at the Renegade University weekend too, I think, at least in part. It's about seeing the world differently than we are trained to. Certainly in politics, you know, in the world I come from, intellectualism, you know, and this goes for the humanities, social sciences, the sciences, right? We are trained to evaluate the world through logic, rationality, reason, etc., right?
Right.
Okay, which can do some stuff. You know, you can build a bridge and, you know, you can probably organize a big company that way or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
A military loves that kind of thinking, right? And it's quite effective in certain ways. But that is a very particular narrow form of discourse, of yes. communication, of seeing, of feeling.
Making sense.
Of making sense. There yes. you go. That's your
yeah.
phrase.
Yeah.
So, and you're saying there's all this stuff, as you were saying before, between us and between yes. people and within a social milieu.
Yeah. yeah.
That goes
and
on.
And that we're all... sort of ecologically figured. We're mm-hmm. contingent beings, right? Mm-hmm. So, the very constitution of my subjectivity or my perspective is already enmeshed with other things. Right. I'm made up of other things. I am a grab bag. I am a remix of the world, right? Mm-hmm. Quite literally, we all have skin, but my skin is this way.
Right.
Right? So we're remixing the world locally according to all sorts of metabolic functions, right?
So are you saying that science cannot predict this conversation? Because science is all about predicting, right? That's their...
Except what's funny about science is
that's where they get all their credibility is when they predict things.
It's so historical based too, though. It's so about
on
what's already happened, right? That it's never open to the emergent, right? It's all about shutting down. Mm. And I would love a science, and science at its best, is actually radically empirical, not just quantitative, but qualitative, and actually accounting for empirical. That's why I think Terence McKenna is a great scientist.
So you want scientists to account for the affective as well?
Like my friend's poetical dictionary, like a dictionary, have knowledge,
right,
take into consideration other things besides that which can be measured.
Okay, how does a scientist, I mean, I would love this, I'm all for it, but how is this gonna happen? How would scientists take account of things that can't be measured? And how would they then factor that into their equations?
Yeah, it would change everything, it would change the methodology fundamentally.
And maybe even the questions they're asking.
Exactly, and so that's why, I realized the article,
different questions,
the blog post I was writing about psychedelics, about being empirical, I realized that what I was talking about was the ancient shaman, the splitting of the poet and the scientist, mm-hmm, and the wise man. Oh, that's a relatively recent phenomenon.
Right.
Right. And I think I realized afterwards that I'm probably talking about something that has already existed.
Yeah.
In which one person was all these things.
Oh, you know what Donald Hoffman said? I love this too. He described all the great theories, all the great scientific theories, as being beautiful.
Oh, it's a man after my own heart.
Right, yes. I know. I mean, he said primarily that's what they are. They're I think that was the first word he used to describe them. They're beautiful theories.
That's what's real scientist. He's empirical.
Right?
Because he's counting for beauty.
I think Eric Weinstein says that too.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not that it's a dominant, the fact that we can talk about science as it or they or science as already lets you know that it's trying to abandon any positionality, any perspectivalness, right? And say, well, it's just this institution, well, according to science. And I don't mean abandoning it at all. It is a way of making sense of the world, but I think it could be radicalized. I think the way we've ghettoized and say, well, poetry is over here and art's over here and science is over here, I think is doing us a great disservice, especially today, where people, you know, I think the claims we want science to have are both sort of impossible and absurd, right? So reading Bruno Latour's book, who I don't know well, so I've just started the book, but he's really trying to address people who are denying climate change, right? And he's saying, well, on what grounds, right? So you have science, bunch of scientists get together and they point out all kinds of data. People are denying it, but like, well, where's your proof? Right? They're like, but it could be these other things, right? Mm-hmm. And science is in this funny position, right? Because like your guy said, there is no theory that can finally be proven.
Right.
There is no such thing as proof, because proof suggests finally the end, some self-certainty, something that is so self-apparent I don't need to talk about it anymore. It just is.
Right.
But that doesn't exist.
Right.
Right? So science has put itself in a funny position, right, of maintaining a kind of radical rationality that is being used by the opponents of its position against itself, right? Saying, well, come on.
Right, where's the proof?
How do you know?
Where's the proof of climate change?
But both of them are beginning from the wrong position
of
assuming there needs to be proof. We make decisions all the time, back to Kairos and the propitious moment. I make decisions all the time, not just based on some rational accounting of the facts. There's so many factors. Decision making and how we understand and believe things is such a complex calculus. We're not rational agents. Rationality is one very important mode of decision making. But it's one mode. I mean, any beginning fucking rhetoric 1A student knows there's ethos, pathos, logos.
Yeah, do that.
Right? So there's...
Break that down, yeah.
So I don't even know, it comes from Aristotle, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's... You know, every argument has a part of it that is logical. Mm-hmm. This is the reason to do this. This is the steps, meaning it's derived from some master principle.
So the logos.
Okay. There's the pathos, which is the pathetic claims, the emotional. Mm-hmm. I just like it. I just love it. It makes me feel good. Mm-hmm. And then there's ethos, which is from what position is the person speaking? What's their authority? Authority can be complicated, because authority doesn't have to in some environments, having a PhD works against you. It's not your authority. So it's not just, it's what is your authority?
Right.
Right? Because it's always situational. It's always perspectival. So what is the position of this argument? How are you coming at me? Are you my friend? Are you my expert? Are you the, what are you saying to me? And there's logical moments and there's pathetic moments or emotional moments. Mm-hmm. Now, Ethos, Pathos, Logos are useful and they're nice, they're key elements. But it's even more complicated because there's all kinds of cosmic forces, right? I mean, anybody who lives in San Francisco, I assume in the world, knows this. You wake up and it is a thick gray fog outside. Mm. And you're like, whoa. It's weighing down on you. And it's weighing down your mood. It's weighing down on your body. Mm-hmm. And you're like, wow, I should feel good. I rationally, right? I got laid last night. I like the job I'm going to. I don't have to go to a job. Everything's looking groovy. Mm-hmm. But you get this mood, right? And mood is so complicated. I don't generate my mood. My mood is generated in my participation with the world around me. And that is a kind of knowledge. And it's, again, not subjective. Mm. It is perspectival. So it is this body, in this place, in this time, in these conditions. There's something called seasonal affective disorder. We mm-hmm. know that there are these other conditions that implicate and inflect the things we believe and think and say and do. One of my favorite quotes ever, is Emerson, our moods don't believe in each other. Right? Because a mood is so absolute.
God, yeah.
And you feel good. You're like, oh, yeah, everything. You'll have some philosophy and you'll have some beliefs and you'll say some things to some woman or your child or people on the street. Yeah. And the next day you have a different mood and you have different beliefs.
Yeah.
And you say different things.
Yeah.
And you don't love that woman all of a sudden. I want mood to become a figure of knowledge, right? To be figured in the epistemological landscape,
okay.
Included within scientific discourse.
Whoa.
As opposed to always exiled. And I don't know what knowledge begins to look like at that point.
What does the process look like? That's what scientists want to know now. That's what a bunch of listeners want to know.
Well,
right,
so I go back. I think one of the great practitioners today is this guy, Lauren Green, who's written two incredible books. One is Poetical Dictionary, mm-hmm. and he talks about the methodology in the beginning. And then he wrote a second book, which is a textbook called Atmospherics, in which he tries to delineate the sort of concepts of affect within experience. Mm. And in the Poetical Dictionary, I talk about this a lot in my book, because what it does is once you introduce affect and once you introduce this sort of breadth and wealth of data into your data set, it changes your posture, it changes your ethos. So rather than the classical scientist who dresses in white and you don't really want to know him, mm-hmm. except he wants to put his name on something so he can get a grant, mm-hmm. but it's somehow his knowledge is not him. It's not contingent on him.
Right.
Right? He's different than his knowledge.
Same even in history.
Yeah.
In Absolutely. Anthropology, in political science. That's what we're trained to do, is to separate ourselves. I was just talking about this with someone. Yeah. I know, and Nietzsche knows, that they are autobiographies.
Right. That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. Nietzsche says this very famously,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I know they're autobiographical, okay? But there's no mention of me, my family, right. Anybody I know, anybody I've ever known is in these books, right? It's right. all, in fact, and 99% of the book takes place before I was born,
right?
Right. It's about American history. But yeah, I'm all up in there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
So here, so...
So we can't... To understand how and why I wrote that book in the way that I wrote that book, you would have to understand all the affect, all the stuff, all the my context, my world, my feelings.
Well, it's there always indirectly.
My moods,
right?
The weather, right, the weather right. in the Bay Area when I was growing up, here, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure.
But now think about the posture. So the academic or the scientist is always after the definitive. So you go back to dictionaries.
Yeah.
I have the Oxford English Dictionary. That's definitive.
Right.
The Webster's unabridged.
Right.
Lauren Green introduces in the Poetical Dictionary, it's not the Poetical, it's just Poetical Dictionary, is this fundamentally different posture mm-hmm. of never seeking to be definitive. It will never have wanted to be definitive. It will always be, I am one amongst many, because it's always perspectival. Mm-hmm. So let's make the knowledge feel as rich as possible. Rather than owning one dictionary, let me own 500 dictionaries. Mm-hmm. Let me have a multiplicity of positions. Mm-hmm. So the book that he and I talked about writing a long time ago is getting a whole bunch of people, or one person could do it if I was Borges, but a book of cosmologies, right? And in fact, I wrote a cosmology at some point, right? And I was waiting for everyone else to do it. Imagine a book of cosmologies. So this book is like, everything is bodies and events. Another book comes along, says nothing. It's all just wind and smoke.
Right.
Each one is true from its perspective.
Uh-huh.
They are often mutually incompatible.
I'm thinking, like, for Hegel, it's the great ideas of the time. For Marx, it's material conditions, and that was their big fight. Right? These are cosmologies, theories of the whole world and how they work.
Exactly. Right? And that's how I've always viewed philosophy, is that rather than having a discussion trying to get to a truth, I see them as an proliferation of multiple worldviews.
Yes, well, sure.
Just different worlds. Mm-hmm. So I don't see them as any conflict. I might or might like, people ask me, why don't you like Hegel? I'm like, I like Hegel's fine. I don't believe Hegel, but that's irrelevant.
Right.
It's like surreal. He's like a great comedian. He's like Charlie Chaplin.
It's like there's the DC universe, there's the Marvel universe, and then there's other universes, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
And you roll with it according to all kinds of...
And you are just as uncommitted to any one of them as you are to the Marvel and DC universes, I assume.
Yeah, and you get more or less attracted
to things.
You're
not like a partisan of one or the other.
But I do get attracted to things. So I'm more attracted to Deleuze and Guattari than I am to Frege.
Sure.
Or whatever the
fuck. But you don't think one is more correct or better in some moral way than the other?
It just feels like, yeah, I like snuggling in bed with them. They smell good. I like the way they smell. I like the way they taste.
But see, again, they're going to come back at you, the modernists. Are going to say, you're just playing games. You're not serious. This is not serious work.
Well, you know, so Nietzsche has this great phrase he uses to describe Plato. Or Socrates, not even Plato. He says Socrates is the great progenitor of serious play.
Uh-huh.
That's just such a great figure, right? We can't separate the two, right? And that's why I asked before what you meant by play. So play when it's opposed to the serious or the true or the state, or right? But when play becomes constitutive, what is more serious? I mean, to me, always, the person who's adamant, the person who is so self-serious about their philosophy or their way of life is missing the point altogether. And this was the Socratic position, of course, right? So Socrates is walking the streets of Athens, and every, you know, sanctimonious douchebag on the street is like, I know what the moral is, I know. He walks up and he keeps asking them questions until they
fall apart.
Yeah, until they abandon ship.
Right.
You know, he's a nudge. And that's why Nietzsche calls him a nihilist, because he brings everything to zero. But he also introduces irony, which is a lighter hold on any position, on any adamant. And this is something I will talk about in Are You Weekend.
Okay.
Which is how, once there is this proliferation of positions, this is something I've been talking a bunch about on Twitter recently. I look at my Twitter feed, and there's all these different, radically different positions, and everyone's so fucking self-sure. Yep. Everyone's so serious.
Yep.
Doesn't anyone go and go, oh, look, there's a multiplicity of positions. Maybe I should hold my position with a little less bile. Right? It doesn't mean abandoning passion.
Right.
And this means abandoning being a fucking douchebag.
And this is different than something I don't like, which is humility.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
it's not the Christian humility you're talking about here.
No,
good.
It's the opposite.
Oh,
it's like Nietzsche. It's Nietzsche, the Ecce Homo, the title chapters are why I am so wise, why I am so clever, why I write such good books. Because this is my position and you own it completely, but it doesn't mean it's your position.
Or the right one.
This is the fucking world. Live in my world or don't. When do I care?
Okay. So do you bring this up on the first date or the second date? How do women respond? Well, how do women respond to you? How's that for a change of topic? So for people who don't know, Daniel and I are of the same age, and we've both been online dating you for longer than I have, but I've been doing it for almost a year now. And you're the only friend I talk about with. Yeah.
Oh yeah, you're the only person I know. All my friends are married.
Right. Yeah. And so people don't want to hear about it.
Right.
For various reasons.
Oh yeah, you're right. That's a good point.
You've experienced this?
Yep, they do not.
So women don't want to hear about it.
Right.
Like female friends, they always say, you should learn how to be alone. You should not be doing this at all.
Everyone says that to me too.
Every female friend.
Every single one of them. You should get in touch with you, and you's always in caps.
Every woman I know has told me, you should not do this. You should learn how to be happy just with yourself.
Yes.
Alone. And I say, I'll take it under consideration. And then I don't bring it up with men because, contrary to popular belief, men don't talk about this stuff. Locker room talk doesn't happen.
It doesn't exist.
Except between you and me. You and I do.
Yeah.
We talk a lot.
Occasionally, one of my married friends will ask for like a really sordid story. And then I get into it. They're like, oh, no.
Yeah, right.
They're like, yeah.
And now you... and you... You're such a disgusting pervert. Yeah. You have written an entire novel about your fantasies as a professor.
It's not even essentially a fantasy. Oh, well.
Yes.
We'll keep going. All
right. Well, is it not? No. Yes, you have.
Yeah.
Yeah, you revel in it.
I don't know if fantasy is the right word, but yes.
Yeah. What would be the right word?
Experiences.
Oh, right? Actual experiences. Yeah. Oh, that's all real in the novel?
Well, no, it's a novel.
All right, we went over this. It's all the same. It's all one continuum.
Exactly.
And right. Okay. So, like, you know, I have issues out there, right? You know, thinking the way I think, yeah. You know, having these ideas, being, you know, not just politically incorrect, but just being in my head in this way all the time, right?
Yeah, it's,
You know, civilians don't think this way, right?
I mean, it's a good word for it.
90% of Americans wouldn't even begin to know what we're talking about.
That's not exactly
they wouldn't
right.
have the first clue. They couldn't even ever even enter this conversation.
Exactly
this
right.
this podcast will never ever cross the ears of at least 90% of it. It has no chance at all, in other words.
Right.
The other 10% is divvied up between those who watch MSNBC, those who watch Fox, those who listen to PBS, those who listen to Joe Rogan, and then the tiny little leftovers are people like me. But anyway.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, when, you know, the dating world, right? These apps, you know, OkCupid, Bumble, what do you like the best?
Oh, I don't know. I always forget which one I'm on. So yeah.
I had someone tell me, actually it was Warren Farrell on a podcast recently, not on the podcast, but he told me afterward, he said, make sure you go on Match.com.
Yeah.
It's been proven that Match.com results in the longest lasting relationships. It's much better than the others, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what
you don't
the
care.
Criteria is to begin with. Yeah, no. That's,
okay.
Yeah.
So, but you know, so we're in the dating world out there. We're like out in the
It's
America.
It's a comedy.
America.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
you
a
and
tragic
I, like,
comedy.
You and I, like, exposed to America.
Yes.
Like, it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
That you and I are, like, we put our face...
It's
us,
a farce.
Here we are,
it's
like...
A farce,
and they look at us and they're like, what is this?
Yes.
You know, they don't even know what to do with it
they
right
don't
half the time.
It, no.
How do you... Tell me about your profile, your dating profile. What does it say?
Jesus Christ, man.
To say,
you know, I don't really know what to do. There's certain
knowledge is affect.
Well, there are certain signifiers that you can try to push out there that you think might have a certain valence in the local economy, right?
Yeah.
So I just double down on I'm a New York Jew. I got a big fucking nose. I'm going to talk about Nietzsche.
Big fucking nose.
And I'm not going on a hike. And I'm going to fucking drink. And I'm going to curse. And what you do when I get are a certain number of responses.
So
like, ooh.
For people who don't know,
who
are not on dating apps in the Bay Area. Everybody on dating apps in the Bay Area, they talk about hiking, travel, and red wine. That's what, at least all the women.
Every single one. So my easiest rule of thumb is the minute they use the word adventure, swipe left.
Bye.
They use the word adventure, they're gone.
Get the fuck out.
Because if they want adventure, I'll show them a fucking adventure. And they're not going for that adventure. Right, so that's going left. Yeah, the red wine thing. I love Napa. I love getting wacky with my girls. That goes left.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, no one's swiping on me, except I satisfy a certain sort of fetishy, who he seems like this kind of thing, he's just smart. And then what inevitably happens is they're like, oh, he wasn't kidding. Well, he is just kind of a solitary pervert, alcoholic, drug out, lunatic who talks about Nietzsche and masturbates all day. You know, so I get like 2 weeks.
Really?
That might not be
no.
true.
So you've had long-term relationships. I know this. You've had long-term relationships. You've had a fiance out of this.
I've fallen in love.
You've fallen in love.
Yeah, twice.
Twice you have fallen
twice
in love.
Twice since my divorce. 10 years. From, fallen in love twice from the internet.
From people you met on dating
from
apps.
Dating apps.
With people you met on dating apps. Twice you fell in love.
Twice.
Huh.
Yeah, it's something, right? That's why I can't really be that critical. It just means it gets thrown back on me to be discerning, right? So... I don't go on a lot of dates because it's so easy. It's like,
it's a beautiful thing.
And then I go on a couple and you either hit a little something off. And to be fair, to be clear, many of the women I've gone out with, even if we don't become anything, I'm still friends with.
Yeah.
Like, I've met some fantastic, and the fact is I just don't hide what I am.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's right out there. Mm-hmm. They don't always believe it. So they're always, some of them are a little disappointed. They're like, oh. They think secretly, I must like hiking or travel. It's like, yeah, not so much. Or he doesn't like to drink that much. You know, like, yeah. Or he doesn't curse that much. Well, and those people, that's easy. But yeah, I've never really fit. I've been in the Bay Area almost 30 years, 29 years. I don't have one person in the city I call to go out with. Not one.
Wow.
Not one.
Why?
There are people I enjoy. I go out and I run into them.
Why?
This is not a city that enjoys irony, that enjoys gesticulation, that enjoy. It's a very conservative, bigoted city.
Oh, yeah, you said it's conservative.
It's
yeah.
Very. So if you're not of a certain ilk, I was out with a, I dropped my kid off the other day, and I ran into my old neighbor, my ex-wife's neighbor, and we're talking, and another guy pulled up, a neighbor, and we're all talking, and somehow they all brought up the election, which is always my biggest fear. I'm not a voter. I don't read news. I've read newspapers since I was 19.
But you just voted this time.
I did vote this time. And I can talk about that if you like.
Just because he's Jewish.
No, because he's fucking interesting.
Did they call you up? The International Jewish organization?
Because our stock went up in value.
Thank you. I'm glad you're being a good Jew.
And somehow some conversation came up, and then he said something, and I said, I don't know. I said, to be honest, if I were a voter in the last election, if I had to vote and I was a voter and it was between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, of course I would have voted for Trump. I mean, and to me, that's so self-evident, right? But like, just because it's interesting.
Well, okay. Yeah, entertaining. You're in it for the entertainment.
Yeah, it's entertainment. Yeah. I'm going to vote for some neoliberal hack who's going to recapitulate the entire system. I'd rather someone disrupt the system for better or worse.
Good man.
Than just recapitulate the same old exploitive terms.
Okay.
War machine.
So that's why you're voting for Bernie. You did vote for Bernie.
I did vote for Bernie.
He's disruptive.
I think he's a character, and he's coming. You know, and part of me comes from I do have a fantasy of a socialism that works. Socialism is so non-paternal, and unfortunately, nothing like living in the state of California to make you hate socialism. Somehow the state of California has decided that they know better than me and my son about how long he should go to school. Like, he's not allowed to drop out. I go to jail if my kid drops out of school at 16. New York, you can do 16. Mm-hmm. Why there's any age at all? I don't know why they think they're meddling in my family business.
You sound like a libertarian, man.
Yeah, it's very confusing to me. But I'm an anarchist. I'm a commie anarchist crypto pervert.
That's exactly what you are.
That's exactly what I am.
Yeah, drug addled too.
Yeah.
Back to love.
But I do want... But I do want the state to take care of shit for me. I want them to pay for my home. I want them to leave me. If I could just sit
That's not here. Leaving you alone. You want the state to pay for your home?
If I don't have to deal with asshole landlords, yeah, and I'm going to deal with...
Then you won't be dealing with an asshole landlord. You'll be dealing with the mayor or the governor.
I hear you.
Or the king.
Hence my ambivalence.
Okay.
But in my fantasy, if I didn't have to stress about... The fact is, right now, the economy is tanking. My landlord's going to kick me out. Mm. I might not be able to live near my son. Mm. He can't drop out of school, so I have to keep him here.
I've been there.
And in public schools...
I've been in exactly the situation.
I'm in a very uncomfortable situation. And to me, the social could have been organized in a different way.
Okay.
But this didn't need to be the case.
I want to finish by talking about your solution to the world's problems, which you have. And we're really serious.
I do.
The crypto.
Mm.
Duh.
Hello. Oh, yeah. I forgot about that all day.
Hello. Yeah. You're going there.
Yeah.
I do want to finish, but I want to get back to the dating and the love thing, you know, because...
Yeah, let's go there. Yeah. So tell me your experience.
No, I will not. No.
I
will. Just give me a second, buddy.
Take your time.
Like you said, love.
Yeah.
Twice.
Yeah.
And you've probably been in love more than that.
In my life? Or?
Yeah. In your life. Maybe.
Yeah. I've been in love by before that 3 times.
Now, wild concept. Wild, right?
Yeah.
Historically freighted like no other concept.
Yeah.
My goodness, you know, what does a person like you make of a word and a concept like love?
Funny, I had a revelation about it relatively recently. I'm very
proud of this question, by the way.
Yeah.
This is one of my best questions. I hope you do well with the answer.
Okay. So I did a little podcast on it. Instead of blogging, sometimes, you know, I don't like to write, so I'll just speak into a mic.
Yeah.
So I did one on love. Oh. And I didn't popularize it because I had to figure out how I felt about it. But it all came from a quote somebody had put on the Twitter from Eric Fromm, who I've never read. Mm-hmm. I know the name, but it doesn't mean more than that. I'm not going to pretend to know anything more than that. And it was something about love is not a feeling, it's an action.
Okay.
And I found that that's been true in all my relationships, that for the most part, I'm good at love as a verb. I'm good at, love to me is a movement of, this comes a lot from my Kierkegaardian training. Kierkegaard was my first major love. and it's this move to the infinite. It's this move to a refraction of all the sort of banalities of the everyday through the infinite. So when I first got, I've only been married once, and I married my fantastic, brilliant, beautiful, now ex-wife. And we said we would never live together without being married. And we did. The day we moved in together, it's the day we ran up the street and eloped. Mm. Because we both knew that day-to-day life as a human being is repulsive. And at some point, you're going to just hate the way the person breathes. Mm. Right? You just are. Mm-hmm. Right? I get annoyed with my kid sitting here. I love my kid more than anything. I rip my eyes out for my kid.
They smell. They smell.
I'm just like, dude, stop breathing like that.
They're messy. Yeah. They breathe wrong.
It's part of just being
and the way they eat is disgusting. Yeah,
disgusting.
No, totally.
So what do you do with that? So if you're not, if it's not refracted through the infinite, if your horizon point is the finite, then okay, well, I don't like the way she breathes. I'm out of here. But if I'm refracted through the infinite, so she breathes funny.
Oh.
Right?
Okay.
And so I was married for 14 years, very happily.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's a constant movement. Love is an internal movement. It's Kierkegaard's language, right? It's not about love, but about faith. It's an internal movement in which you move to the move from the finite to the infinite and back. That's how he defines the night of faith, his apogee of sort of life, of existence. It's the person who walks through the banality of the everyday without disdaining it.
Okay.
Because those are the monks. Those are the people who say, no, I'm gonna disdain this life. I'm gonna take an ascetic, vow.
Yep.
And I'm not gonna speak, I'm not gonna eat, I'm not gonna fuck. Okay. He's like, okay. But he kind of doesn't like those people. The people who make that move to the infinite, everything is through the infinite, and then come back to the finite. And then with each step they take, they're in the finite and the infinite. They don't mind, they relish washing dishes.
Mm-hmm.
Not because that's the end in itself, but because that's something too. And then the infinite is a kind of horizon point of infinity, of this endless regress. So that the micro sort of fetishy fucking kvetches about this or that action pale.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I don't like the way she breathes. I see her sleeping and she's breathing. And then if my horizon is the cosmos receding across all time and place. Yeah, that's fuck. What's my problem?
What if she voted for Clinton? What if she's? But you have to choose someone.
Mm-hmm.
You're choosing someone in particular. Maybe some people, but right.
Yeah.
So, in other words, you can apply this idea of the infinite to friendships, to anybody.
Absolutely.
Right?
Okay. And in fact, it's the same.
Yeah. Okay, so for you, love is choosing a particular person.
Or it's not that it's choosing as much as it's making a move. So it's a kind of choice, but yeah. I don't want to make it so rational. What choice has that kind of sense. But it is, because a lot of it's responding to it. I'm attracted as much to my male friends as my female friends. I'm not going to fuck them, but I'm attracted to them. I want to be around them. I like being in their world.
Mostly
right?
Me.
Yeah.
But so, how do you come to be, it's a choice. How do you come to choose a particular person? Or what's
saying a little bit if it's a middle voice, right? Because it's, now if I was being purely rational about it, I've chosen badly, right? Two times in a row, right? Basically love with two women, both of them ended up dumping me, right? Or just not wanting really to pursue it with me. Because I think.
How do you think you come to that point? What happens with you to get you to that point where that's I finally got the question out.
Well, I feel like, you know, you size it up. So I wrote a piece on this a long time ago for Thought Catalog, and I was writing for them a long time ago. And I was like, you know, it doesn't really matter who you're with. And I truly believe that, that it's because it's the internal movement. It's not about the one. It's about, I could take any woman I've dated pretty much my entire life, and they're all, they got their good things, they got their bad things. If I really got to do a pro and con list, it doesn't work. It's really about making that internal move and then making the internal move back. It doesn't really fucking matter, right? All these women, they're all smart and clever and sexy in their own different ways.
What if they love traveling?
Yeah, so then it gets down to this very practical thing. That's what happens. So here's what happens.
You're not going to the infinite with her.
Here's what happens.
You're not even going traveling with her.
Here's what happens to me is this is both two women in a row, the two women I've loved since I've married, both said to me at some point, well, you're not really the activity partner. I really want an activity partner. You're not an activity partner. Right. And I realize they have no idea what love is because what the fuck do you care? You're not fracking through the infinite. You really want an activity partner? You fucking kidding me? Like, I'll do some things with you because we are in the finite. Uh-huh. So let's say I go camping with you one in every five times. The other four times, go with someone fucking else. Are you going to sit and read Nietzsche with me? Really? You're going to sit here and fucking do MDA and we're going to talk about the fine points of Deleuze while you lick my anus? Like, what the fuck? That's my thing. Your thing is going camping. I don't... I expect you to do it sometimes, but
too.
Not all of
that's
time.
Your thing.
But it's like, I don't understand. And if you can't give up that holding on to that finite need, your horizon isn't there. And so that those people, I made the move, but they couldn't make the move back.
Which philosopher goes best with rimming is what I want to know. Like, let's nail that down.
Yeah, they're all sort of didn't do that well. I don't think
I let you drink on
well
the podcast, and this is what happens. Jesus Christ, Daniel. So love is, it's a choice though. It's choosing
it's
someone.
It's a movement.
It's a movement with a particular person though.
Yes, it's an internal movement with that.
And you have no idea why you happen to choose those two women. You must.
Yeah, you get some, I think part of
there's
it
some
is.
Some pattern in you, something you understand about yourself, no, or think, was it no, just think, em- think, was it just emergent? Was
I
it just spontaneous?
Emergent. I think some of them have, there's this little bit of physical chemistry, and although both, very different dynamics psychosexually, but both have some sort of appeal in the psychosexual realm, some sort of attract where you just feel, I mean,
They're just like your mother.
One of the figures I'm drawn to is magnetism and gravity, right? These sort of figures of attraction, right? Ooh. That science loves. But I don't think they explore nearly thoroughly enough. The way two bodies just go towards each other. They just do. Why do I read Deleuze, but I find Frege unreadable?
Right.
I don't know.
You can't explain it.
It's rhythmic. It's harmonic convergence. It's sine waves.
And are you not interested in trying to explain it?
That is my explanation.
Is what?
That it's a question of flow and rhythm. You know, you get in a flow and it was someone that doesn't flow, it's dissonant.
But you don't want to explain the cause. You're not interested in explaining causality.
In some sort of psychoanalytic sense, I think that's a false, I think it's a red herring.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Yeah, I think the reasons we're attracted to some people and not others, even often at our own detriment. I mean, one of the women I was in love with was terrible for me. I mean, just not nice to me at all. It was sort of terrible.
Been there, yeah.
But, you know, you feel a draw. You just do that. And I didn't care because I was in that rhythm and I was willing to ride it all the way out. I didn't need to rashly step back. I wish she was more supportive of me. I wish she... You know, like I didn't give a shit because there's another dimension of flow, and we could psychoanalyze, but psychoanalysis is such a limited fucking rubric.
Isn't it just odd though? I mean, I'm going to sound like really pedestrian here, but isn't it just odd that, you know, of all the thousands or however many women and men who have come across us, you know, come just a handful, two, three, four, whatever it is, right? We have this very particular, very specific set of feelings about that we do not experience in any other way with anyone else ever.
Totally. Yeah.
And it is consistent with what the culture tells us is love.
I see where we're headed, but...
I don't know what's going on in my head when I fall in love. When I fall in love, it feels like what the culture says is falling in love. I feel like I'm doing a normal thing, maybe even a good thing.
Yeah,
and I'm wondering how much of that is causing me to have these feelings, right?
That's great, yeah, sure.
Is that
very good?
Is that good?
Yeah.
I think it's pretty good.
I think it's really good. And it complicates
and it just,
it.
It just makes me, well, it fucks me up, right? It just makes me skeptical about what I'm doing here and whether this feeling is really,
I think you just need to get in touch with you.
Yeah.
So that's something I do actually believe. I don't need some fucking female friend to tell me that. But
actually, you told me the other day when I called you up and I was like fucked up about women, and you were like, "Go inside," and you meant go internally, and you and I both said the Buddhists are right about everything, right? Just
it's a Zen idea thing to go for to be in a relationship to seek a relationship because I have a lack versus seeking a relationship out of plenitude.
Yeah. Which is common relationship advice nowadays, which is actually very solid, and we agree with that.
And there's something very beautiful about that.
And you and I both are very inspired by Zen and Buddhism and these insights. And that's right. When the people in the relationship are bothering you, go inside.
Yeah. Yeah.
call, yeah. The call's coming from inside.
And if you
out.
Find yourself in this position, where I have found myself here, where I'm like, I need ego confirmation.
Yep.
Back to this ego thing, right? Yep. I need confirmation. Yep. I need to be loved. I need to be, and for me, a lot of it's desire. I have a lot of physical self-hatred. I have a lot of self-loathing, and I want to be desired.
Mm-hmm.
And I, well, at least I fuck. Mm-hmm. Even though the sex might not even be good, even though my
Someone wants to fuck me.
And imagine finding your value. Yeah. In an economy of desire.
Right.
That's
nice.
It's easy and difficult, but it's also so draining. Mm. It's not an economy that fuels your vitality. Right? At desperation, you're spending so much energy seeking the thing that to then fill you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a little bit of luxury of being now in my 50s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and being like, yeah, what the fuck do I need?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and at my best, I am that. I'm not always that. But at my best, at my best being at my healthiest, feeling healthiest, physically healthiest, psychologically healthiest, vital, self-contented, I'm not, we talked about earlier, you know, approaching women.
Yeah.
Right? And the nerve of that.
Like, I wouldn't do it ever.
Right. And there's a point at which one can be dependent on it. But imagine not being dependent on whether they say yes or no.
I know. The men who do that, I'm simultaneously sort of disgusted by them, but and also in awe of them, and also envious of them.
Yeah.
The handful of men,
yeah.
And it's really a handful,
yeah.
Right? Who actually approach women in bars like cold?
Yeah,
that's I've never done that in my life. I can't imagine ever doing it. Thank God for dating apps, right? But yeah, that's something. Well, Nietzsche certainly would approve of this. That kind of behavior, right? And why not, right? What's to lose? Exactly.
And if you have that kind of self-contentment, I'm just like, oh, you look nice. You want to get a drink.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe you're a douche, maybe I'm a douche, but how do we know until we get a drink?
Yeah.
And
all right. So I do have one last question before we solve the world.
Yeah.
World's problems.
Yeah.
So you had a lot to say about the movie The Joker.
Mm.
Or is it just Joker?
Joker.
Just Joker. Give us your take on it, because your take is quite different
than
most people. And
you've thought about that movie in a while.
You have a very positive take on it. Well, yeah. You know, I'm thinking it's about love, dating, relationships, men, women. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, to me, that movie is very powerful, and it's fundamentally about, for me, everything I've seen Tom Phillips say. I was sort of like, yeah, that's what I take from this movie, is that culturally, what happens to those who just simply can't make it?
Mm.
Right? There's a lot of people like that. And the fact is, I feel like that often too, right? I'm going to unravel. I just want to sit in a corner and shit myself babble.
At any minute, we could be out in the street being schizophrenic homeless person on Market Street.
Yeah, and I feel that. I've been in client meetings. I've been in big, powerful meetings with CEOs, and I'm wondering, half step away, am I about to shit myself and evacuate myself and fall on the floor babbling, and what will become of me?
You too, huh? Yeah, I have the same thing.
And
I do.
Yeah, that's one of those things you bring up with a woman. They're like, they look at you like, huh?
They're like, maybe I'm not so attracted
to
you anymore.
Maybe. Said that, yeah.
I think I swiped the wrong way on that one. yeah.
But that movie is really just fundamental. What do you do with people who, you know, his claim is his revolution was never based on labor. Right? So his critique of what we might call capitalism, for lack of a better word, but of American culture, of whatever's happening.
Mm-hmm.
The revolution around him, all their sons, was eat the rich. But he liked his job. He had no problem with his job. He had no problem working. He had never complained about that once. He loved being
right.
A clown.
Mm-hmm.
His problem was that he can't always function, and that people literally won't even look at him. That there's this power of just being recognized as having any value whatsoever. And when you breed a culture that at some point just will not even look at you. So I've heard this is a common thing about homeless, is that they'll say, people have conversations right in front of us like we're not there.
Mm.
Okay. You know? And that absolute lack of a recognition of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's a movie. That's why I was so surprised by the reactions to that movie, because it's speaking to such a basic thing. Just recognize that somebody is living.
Right.
And maybe needs a little help.
Mm.
What's so fucking wrong about that? Why do you let that person go?
Because they're white men.
Yeah, I mean, that part...
That's what it's about, right?
What's funny to me, though, is the,
we don't
the
care.
People that turned me on to that movie, got most excited about that movie, were women.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's good.
And we're most passionate about that film. And I only saw the movie from a female I know, a woman I know as a friend, and brilliant theorist and poet. And cheers me to see. I want to go to see some fucking Hollywood movie. It never occurred to me to see that movie.
Huh.
I like Joaquin, but whatever.
Wow.
Not a big huge fan of The Hangover. You know, like Tom Phillips is fine, but whatever. It's fine, but I don't need to go. I don't follow the Phillips oeuvre.
Right.
You know, but Kat in New York, you know, urged me to see it, and she was fucking right. And it really touches on, you know, and a lot of the women I know who saw it and loved it, and I made it for some female friends I know. I encouraged them to see it. Mm-hmm. And they went and saw it, and they recognized themselves on the screen.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. They're like, that's how I feel.
Oh my God.
You know.
Oh.
And so the whole white man thing, I never really understood. It's just identity politics, once again, going, I don't know. I don't even want to talk about it because it's so fucking awful and
so depressing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a wrong turn.
Yeah. Okay.
In every politics. I know for some reason that's considered leftist politics, but it seems super right end, well, right wing politics.
A lot of the left is rejecting it too, thank God.
Right. Yeah. But whatever that identity politics movement seems to me super conservative.
Conservative is the
super
word.
Super Taliban-esque and super fundamentalist. I love that the most radical movements alive today are the fucking fundamentalists, are Muslims bombing shit, trying to take down American capitalism and identity politics. I was like,
oh right,
yeah, I don't know what happened.
Where are we
here.
Supposed to be? Yeah,
yeah, I don't know how things got to that position. Where are the good old? Where's Allen Ginsberg? You know, getting sucked off while talking about communism. Like, where's good natured fucking radicals?
I'm so glad you brought up the 60s, 50s, really 50s Ginsberg is 50s, 60s counterculture. You are a big fan of Ginsberg, Allen Ginsberg, as am I.
Yeah.
And this is, I want you to teach at least one course on the Beats and Ginsberg, you know, for Renegade University. And Burroughs, who I don't know at all, but you're a big fan and expert on Burroughs. Just like briefly, like a lot of people don't know these guys, but like what turns you on about Ginsberg and Burroughs?
Well, Ginsberg's funny because I actually love him for his language. I think he's I think he's just a great fucking poet.
Yeah.
I think it's often overlooked about him, right? It becomes a cultural icon. It becomes reduced to this historical signifier.
Right.
But he's actually a master poet. Mm. You know, his rhythm, I mean, is just outrageous. Just exquisite and outrageous. I mean, I've read Howl a million times out loud, and it never ceases to amaze me. Just simply what's happening with language. The level of just linguistic delight.
That poem, Howl, by Allen Ginsberg, and I think much of his poetry and maybe even some of his prose has been compared to bebop, jazz.
Yeah.
Do you read that way?
100%. Okay. And he's aware of that. So he's fucking with these rhythms. And just when you're in a rhythm, he'll go off, right? He'll syncopate you know, there's a great scene in David Cronenberg's Naked Lunch where they're sitting around. It's the Ginsberg character. They're not called Ginsberg, but it's the Ginsberg character and the Kerouac character. And they're debating about editing. And the Kerouac character saying, no, man, you can't edit ever. You just got to let it flow.
Right.
And the Ginsberg character's like, what are you talking about? I edit every line a million times. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's, to me, the prose stands for itself, right? Kerouac is a fine figure, but a forgotten prosist.
Yeah.
And Ginsberg will remain a master poet. I mean, just on another level of his poetry.
Yeah.
One of the great parts of Howl is the second part where all of a sudden he goes into holy, 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 holy asshole, holy, blah, 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 blah. Everything is holy. Your asshole's holy. Everything's holy. And it's so gorgeous and it's such a, it's an ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's all of a sudden, it's this mode, I think you were talking about, of 60s rebellion as a kind of affective state as opposed to this policing of actions and the self-seriousness and the sanctimony, or even the old left with its sanctimony and its seriousness. Yep. And I was saying, Ginsberg going, oh, fuck, man, oh, fuck, I'm going to get fucked in the ass by Hell's Angels all night, tripping, shooting heroin, I love this, I hate that, I just keep going, man, I got drugs in my pubic beard, I'm busted at the border, holy, 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 holy.
His
holy.
Body isn't everything. Yeah. His body's always there, right?
Yes, exactly. Oh my God, that's gorgeous.
All your paraphrasing there was his body.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And in the dirtiest,
in the dirty, smelly, closest beard
ways.
And loving and smiling and laughing. I saw him read a few times when I was in college.
You saw him?
Yeah, a few times.
I never saw him.
And each time we'd all get excited and talk to him. At some point, he'd proposition us. He'd like, you guys want to come up to my room?
Every time.
We never did that. We all got nervous. Like, our homophobia, like, in 19 wasn't there.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, come back to my room. And I was like, yeah, fucking A, man. You know? Burroughs is in a very different world.
Yeah.
You know, Burroughs, it's funny to me that I know that they were close and they were lovers and all that kind of stuff, but Burroughs in a whole nother, we've yet to catch up with Burroughs. Mm. You know, Burroughs was a...
Tell me why I should read Burroughs, why I should care.
Burroughs has an understanding of the relationship between, you know, the geopolitical state, identity, language, and ideas, and experience that makes him, first of all, function at a different situation. He's not really a novelist. He's not a philosopher. He's not like Hunter Thompson, who I also love, whose position was clear. Mm-hmm. Right? Hunter Thompson was clearly commenting. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Burroughs is commenting, but he's inside. He's rearranging. He's creating new possible worlds. Mm. He saw the rise of the international fascist drug state so early, and the levels of control that happened through the political, through the affective, through the discursive, and his whole thing about cutting up language was that language is this virus. It occupies us and controls us, and you literally need to break it. So he's literally inventing grammars. Inventing whole modes of identity that will always be multiple and very peculiar sexualities. You know, it's just call him like a homosexual writer. It's so reductive because mm-hmm. his sexuality is so out there. He's fucking aliens. You know, and his idea or his figures of how he constructs what counts as a novel. You look at his books, like, what is this? It's so sui generis. It is so... defies, belies anything you think is anything. Hmm. What is this? That was my first experience reading Burroughs. Like, what the fuck is this? Where do I even begin? Is this poetry? Is this philosophy? Is this just demented dream? What is this? You know, and I think most people associate him with Naked Lunch, which is this kind of, it's called a fever dream, as I get.
Yep.
But, it, you know, he got more and more sophisticated in his last trilogy. It's just on another level of what literature, ideas, language, and the relationship someone can have to ideas and culture can be.
So what it is you found is another level of literature.
Another level of literature and another level of thinking and what it means to think, this embodied thinking that will always be, that will so aggressively refuse any terms of identification. Mm. He will never call himself a libertarian. Mm. He'll never call himself
gay.
You know, gay. He never does. He's just doing his fucking thing. He is an individual leading this life and partaking in chance. That's why he loved the cut up, and he loved the cut up technique, which would be cutting up his own work and other people's work and seeing what comes. Mm. Radically introducing chance in the emergent. Mm. Because he never, like Nietzsche, he never separated chance from fate. You are how you roll with chance. And so he also has shotgun art, which I'm not so a huge fan of, but I like the idea of where he would take out, you know, a can of paint and take a shotgun and the canvas is behind it. Mm-hmm. But that he's in the flow of it. Yep. He's not this adamant guy, this is my doctrine. He's in the middle. He never seeks to be outside. He's always situated in the middle. And it's ugly and grotesque and funny and dark and so just ribald and so vaudevillian. And it's... He's to me, I always consider Burroughs like the Chuck Jones of literature. But Chuck Jones, you know, with ass fucking and tons of drugs.
It's been a lot of ass fucking references in this podcast.
A surprising number.
I don't know if iTunes is going to allow this, or YouTube, certainly. But we'll edit it.
Don't mind profanity. They don't sense of profanity, do they?
You never know with them. Yeah. Okay, so you are going to change the world radically. A firm you're working with, as the director of communications will, specifically. And... you all mean it. And I think if it's true what you say, you know, and this thing comes to fruition, I think you will change the world. So, and believe it or not, it's all connected to what we've been talking about.
I think so too.
Right? Okay, cool.
So too, yeah.
Okay, so the name of the startup firm you're working with is, I always forget the pronunciation.
Anatha.
Anatha.
It comes from Anatha Pindika, who was a disciple of the Buddha, was a business owner. And funded tons of shit.
Oh, really?
And created these communities of flourishing.
I didn't know that. Yes. Okay. And the head of it is a guy named Ed Hickman.
Yep.
Right? And you're the director of communications.
Yep.
Okay. So tell us how, and this is, you know, I always bust your guys' balls for not being clear about what the actual product will be. So tell us what Anatha is promising to do.
So what we're promising to do, but also what we think the promise of decentralized smart contract technology, people call blockchain is one technology, there are other decentralized technologies, is ushering in what we call the information age, what Ed Hickman calls the information age economy. If the the existing model of the economy is premised on oil and extraction, everything's extractive, right? So it's always about people at the center who can extract value. How much value can I get from this user? And that's literally how our business models are done.
Okay, so oil is the old economy.
That's
The new economy, right?
The economy is premised on information.
But there's extraction, you're saying, there too.
Right, and so in the existing model,
Facebook
and Twitter, and basically every company, they're extracting our data.
Right.
And our data is who we are, but it's everything you click. It's everything you like. It's everything you search for.
Everything
it's
you purchase.
All your activity, everything you purchase, everything you think about purchasing, everything you're doing in an online environment is being monetized and being deployed.
They take your data.
To sell you things.
They take your data and then they sell it to other parties, sometimes the federal government.
Exactly.
Or other companies or whatever.
And it all becomes seamless. The line between the sort of corporate surveillance and state surveillance.
So I don't think anyone would disagree with that. That's just a statement of what's going on. Okay.
So the premise is that, and it's a very clean premise, is that that information is yours.
The premise of Anatha is that
the premise,
should
the premise
be
of
yours.
This idea of an information age economy.
It can and should be yours. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And that you're using somebody else's platform.
In a proprietary way.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you're using their platform and their technology, so it's not 100% yours financially, but that you have rights, financial claims on that property. That it's your property.
Okay.
And that the red herring is that they keep framing it in terms of privacy, right? And everyone says, well, I like ads served to me. I like to know. What am I protecting?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a question of privacy. Privacy is a red herring. It's really about property. Okay. It's really about literally what you're owed.
Okay.
Right. So now imagine. So, if you look at the richest companies in the world and the assets that drive the most value, information has surpassed oil.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Apple, Facebook, Microsoft are the biggest companies in the world.
Yep.
Google. They've surpassed ExxonMobil.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So information has surpassed oil, and yet the information is yours. Oil's coming up out of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine if oil coming up out of the ground, we had said, well, who owns that? And we'd said, well, it's everybody's because it's under the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That all the revenue that was generated from that oil would have been distributed equally amongst everybody in the world. We could have said that.
Okay.
But we didn't.
Yes.
We said, no, there's property rights and the oil there is mine. Information, well, that's yours. So now imagine you are an oil well. So you are literally creating value in everything you do. The minute you go online, the minute you check your email, the minute you surf the web, the minute you comment, the minute you literally create content.
Right.
I mean, you and me, look how much content we're creating for the internet.
Right.
It's
information that can be used and monetized
and
by others.
And is used and monetized by others.
Right.
But we're not sharing
every click on the internet is information, right? There's information that I went from here to here on the internet. And that is a piece of information that can and has been used to monetize other people's
ventures. And to make the biggest companies in the world.
Right.
And yet we're given free use of their products sometimes, and we're considered that's enough.
Right.
And yet they're seeing profits.
Okay.
So the richest people in the world are Jeff Bezos.
Now, how are you going to give us property
rights
over our
information?
So the idea is to create
a new economic engine. So one of the things that blockchain and smart contracts allow for is you have a digital identity. And you go online, and everything you interact with, the minute you interact with them, initiates certain terms of what's called a smart contract, and you can agree or disagree to those terms. So let's say it looks just like Facebook, and you're on there, and someone wants your ad, it wants your data to sell you ads.
Mm-hmm.
You can opt in or opt out, and it immediately generates revenue to you. You're immediately paid there on the spot.
Okay.
Our existing economic tools, because they're all centralized, that's almost impossible to do. If Facebook wanted to pay us for our information, how the hell would they do it? I can't even get paid by my clients. For me to get paid by my client has to go through at least two banks, me, them, two banks, and usually a third party like Bill.com, right? Or PayPal, someone intermediating, right?
Yep.
Five parties when there should just be two parties.
Right.
Right?
Okay.
So what smart contracts in the blockchain allow for is peer-to-peer payment. So it allows the economic framework for immediate payment And it's smart contract, so it's just smart contract mean that it immediately kicks into gear. It just, it knows the terms, it just distributes. Nobody's okay. in control of it. It just, you've agreed to it or you haven't agreed to it, and it just simply distributes.
Okay.
So now imagine a social platform or your banking, whatever you're doing, in which you are constantly profiting from your very activity. You are an oil well, right? You're just generating value
yep.
as you're creating the world. And what you shift towards, and it sounds so highfalutin, but it's actually very practical. It's an engineering question.
Yeah.
It's not that complicated. We're building it. It's right there.
I was going to say, so is this going to be like an interface on your computer?
Yes,
so
when, it'll be on your phone or your computer.
So when you yep. become a member of Facebook, it'll start interfacing with Facebook and say, well, Facebook, you know, all the information you have to pay me for.
Right. It won't be Facebook. Facebook's not giving up its stuff, but it'll be a new social network.
Oh, I see. So it's an okay. So it has to
unless Facebook changes.
Right.
Right. And creates a UI.
Or you become big enough that they're forced to deal with this.
Exactly. So what will happen? We will look back in 10, 15 years and we will see Google and Facebook as the robber barons of our era.
Right.
They robbed us blind and got the fuck out of there, and they will disappear. Because all you have to do is think about is free market. Right? That's why it's not, we don't need government intervention. That's the beautiful part about it, is you can just say, well, you can belong to this community that takes all your value and keeps the wealth for themselves, or you can do the exact same thing over here and get paid.
Okay. So you're building a whole alternative community with its own social media platforms in it, its own Facebooks and its own Twitters inside of it. I see. Okay.
And what we're mostly building is the ability for anyone to build those.
A whole economy.
We're trying to build an entire set of economies, so we don't want to be the only one.
Gotcha.
We're building the set of software. We're building our own community.
Okay.
But we don't really care if you join our community. Join any community. Use our software. Plug and play.
Okay.
And so you can just say, I want to build my community of registered Renegade University for unregistered podcast or the yoga community or...
Right.
You know?
And every piece of information that comes from you will be monetized for
on
your behalf.
And you can opt in or opt out. You can say, you know what, I don't want you to take any of my data. I don't need your money.
So it's community building. So you got to do a lot of public relations. Got to do a lot of marketing. Got to get the word out. It has to be a movement. It has to be a social movement.
Yeah.
Doesn't it?
And it's a proliferation of social movements. So the fact is, rather than right now we have pretty much a dominant monopoly, right? The dollar on currency.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Right. But now imagine the currency is now competitive.
Right.
That's one of the more exciting things about cryptocurrency is it makes currency competitive. Mm-hmm. And so why would I continue to use U.S. dollar when the way it's used for an enormous war machine, I don't really see that much benefit from it. I want to only use currency that fits my values. Mm-hmm. So you'll join communities and use currencies that fit your values. And you might have 10 different ones.
I love it.
And there are companies like Cosmos who are building the interface between them all. So you can just flow between them.
I love it.
And it really is this kind of commie anarchist crypto pervert fantasy.
Without the state, without a government.
There's no state. We don't need a state at all. Yeah.
Then
because
it's
the state just gets in the way. If the state just backs the fuck off, this thing could really flourish. They're getting in the way right now. Left
Amen.
And right. Now, how roads and all that still, I mean, I know that's the classic libertarian thing. How do libertarians deal with roads?
Oh.
That still needs to be free. We'll get there. I'm not worried.
You can build roads.
Yeah, get there.
Yeah.
We'll get there. But in the meantime, it's really just beginning from this basic premise of information is yours. It is being stolen from you. If you withheld that value from Facebook, the economy will crumble.
Mm-hmm.
If you just withheld your thing, I'm not going to go on the internet.
Go on strike.
Go on fucking strike.
That's right.
That's why I voted for Bernie.
An information strike.
You will shut down.
That's right.
The world's largest company.
That's right.
Overnight.
That's right.
And so imagine now.
There is no information technology without information.
Yeah. And the red herring is we keep being told it's privacy and we all go, oh, I don't really care about privacy. Why do I care?
Yeah.
Do I really care? Oh, they're spying on me. Some people really care about that.
It's worth money, jackasses, is what you're saying.
It's fucking property.
Yeah.
It's fucking property.
Yeah.
And that changes the entire game and it changes all the economic tools. And what you get is like oil, which is fundamentally scarce. It just is
right.
At its core. There's only so much oil.
Well, that's actually not totally true, but go ahead.
At some point we run out. Right?
But but you can remake it. Like fracking has, you can make it into a new product. So it's actually sort of infinite in itself. Yeah. But it's a separate issue.
Information is
the Alex Epstein episode, yeah. Everyone. Listen to that.
Oh, yeah. I'll watch that. Yeah. I would like to know more. I talk out my ass all
but
the time.
But it's okay. No, but your basic point is.
But right. Information is essentially regenerative. Yes. Every time. Yeah. So it's not like you've given up all your information already to Facebook. You're constantly generating new information.
Right, right, right.
Your information is not just who you are and where you live. Yeah. It's everything you do, everything you buy, everything you click,
right.
Everywhere
you
go,
say.
Everywhere you move, when you get married. Yeah, it's everything you say and do.
Dig it.
And that's been being monetized. Why shouldn't we all see the value of that? And then you shift the entire economic terms of the world into an economy of abundance in which poverty and shit like that is unnecessary.
Okay.
Everybody's profiting.
I like it. I like it. This is the clearest I've heard it explained to me. And we've been talking about this for a while now.
That's true. Yeah,
it's not your
better.
Fault.
No. It's getting better because you got to shift. For me, it's always about finding the horizon point.
But it's a social,
like, where do you begin?
It's a social movement that you guys need.
Yes.
You need to build a social movement. So you need to be on podcasts and getting the word out there.
Yeah, as we're beginning to kind of
talking about it. Places like this.
Same time you're building technology, right? So you're taking time to build technology.
So Anatha.com, is that the website?
Anatha.io.
Anatha.io, yeah.
Right, which is still pretty vague right now.
Yeah.
Again, we're not.
But you just wrote a piece. Summer. You just everybody. This is what everyone should do. Instead of going to Anatha.io, go to your recent piece.
Go to Medium. There's a novel publication on Medium in which I've written a bunch of articles.
Yeah,
I just wrote one
recently, which spells it out really well. So that's the one people should look at.
Absolutely, yeah, I think it's good.
Okay, so we did drugs, we did sex, did dating. That was good. That was and now we solved the world's problems.
Look at that, just like that. It's easy.
Yeah, little tequila, little beer. That's all you need.
We win.
Love you.
What a pleasure, man. What a true delight.
Always.
Thank you so much.
Always, always.
What an honor.
You're the best.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To become a member of Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. Thanks for watching.